Hey there, Mark Fennell here, and I have a brand new podcast. No one saw it coming. Each week, we hunt for seemingly insignificant moments that change the course of history, and let me tell you, we've found some wild ones. Like the murder that caused absinthe to be banned pretty much everywhere for around a century, and the wrong turn that started a world war. It's the podcast that will completely change the way you look at history. No one saw it coming. Find it now on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Petal Ashmole Winstanley began dancing ballet as a five-year-old, and ballet eventually took her to London via a stint as a go-go dancer in Paris. It was through ballet that Petal met the first two great loves of her life. And it has been the love of good men alongside her enduring love of ballet that has given Petal a really rich and actually quite wonderful life. Hi, Petal.
Hello.
As I say, you started ballet classes at five. Tell me about your first teacher. Who was she?
Yes, Madame Kara Busloff in Western Australia, a Russian exotic woman who really bewildered little Perth, spoke many languages, and she entranced me, really, and I stayed with her in her care until I was 18.
What did she look like, this Russian in Perth?
She was tall, as I said, exotic, suntanned, and I remember one image I have of her. She was strutting down Murray Street and she looked like an Afghan hound. These great striding, graceful steps, beautiful legs, feet and hands. And of course, she had great faith in me.
I imagine someone, you know, very strict. Did she have that attitude to her young charges?
Yes, she was strict. But, you know, she loved us so dearly. She was passionate. And that was what was so attractive. And it was something that I looked for and longed for when I left her.
And Petal, did you love dancing right away?
Oh, absolutely. And still, I can't live without it.
What was it as a little girl that grabbed you?
I escaped in many ways. I was an adored child, born late in life to my parents. They were in their 40s when they had me. My mother said I was her menopause baby. And she also had, she was severely depressed, I realise now. But to me at the time, she was just having one of her issues. And I would dance for her. And I would dance around the lounge room and she would put on classical music for me. And I learned to navigate around her through dancing. But of course, that was a very, very important skill because I used that skill later on in my career to navigate around ambitious directors, people who, you know, ran ballet companies and the politics. I learned to read the room and I'd learned to do that from my mother.
So as a young dancer, your first dream was to join the Australian Ballet.
Yes.
And that didn't work out.
No, it didn't.
You auditioned twice?
Twice. First for the school and then for the company. And in fact, my mother wrote to the director of the school. She was outraged because she wanted me to do this because she saw that I looked as though I couldn't live without it. And she got a response from Dame Margaret Scott. My mother didn't ever show me the letter, but she said the letter was curt, which so tells us all we need to know.
What did your Russian teacher, Madame Kira, suggest you do then?
Oh, overseas. She must go to London. London is for her, for my beautiful Petal. Yes.
What did your parents think about you heading off to London as a teenager?
Well, of course, when I made up my mind to go to London, my father was absolutely, he thought it was some fanciful idea I'd cobbled up and I needed to be a nurse because clearly ballet as a profession was not for me. And if I wanted to do this, I had to collect my own fare, leave £100 with him and have £100 in my purse. So he said, off you go, get that sorted and then we'll talk about it.
And did you?
I did.
How?
I opened a tiny ballet school under the umbrella of Madame. I worked for her every single day after school. That was where I learnt about training and travelled with her to country towns to watch her teach and assist her, really. And she knew what was happening. She knew I had to get away. So she paid me. a tiny amount, but I got it together. And then she very kindly put on a little performance for me, which gathered a few pennies. So when I said to my father, there we are, I've got the ticket, I'm on the Canberra, she comes through here, the liner, P&O liner, on the 21st of October, and I turn 18 on the 14th of October.
And I'll be on that liner.
And my father said, what can I do? And all the while, my mother had been saying, because be a nurse, really. My mother was like, don't listen, be a ballerina.
So you got on that boat.
I did.
It must have been such an exciting moment. Mm. What were those weeks on board ship like?
Well, you know, I had nothing to go to. I mean, I look at it now and I think, good God, you know. But I had no fear, and I think that those two women, my mother and my ballet teacher, very feisty women, you know, there was no fear about what I was going to do. I knew that there had to be a place for me in that big ballet world, no matter what the Australian ballet said. And being on that ship, I'd sort of gathered a family for a moment.
Were you still keeping up your training?
Oh, yes.
Practicing? How?
Oh, yes.
Where?
In ships, you know, they have that lovely rail everywhere, down every corridor. And one of the lovely stewards, I chatted him up a wee bit, and he said, oh, I'll get you down there in an alleyway where you can do your practicing. And he did. And so I used to go down there every day and practice and try and keep in some sort of shape.
So once this liner docked in England, where did you head? I mean, did you step straight into your life as a prima ballerina?
No. We got to Tilbury, and out on the wharf there were all the suitcases, you know, and I found mine. I also realised I had to get into London, so I spoke to one of the officials and said, how do I do this? And he said, well, here, love, there's a bus over there. So I got on the bus and got into Earl's Court, the Overseas Visitors Club, which I kind of knew about, checked out the notice board and found a room in Tregunta Road, which wasn't too far away, dumped my case in there. The landlady said, hey, you're Australian. Oh, we don't like them. Too many baths, too many showers. We only got one bathroom, love. One bath a week. I thought, oh my goodness. I remember saying to my mother, these English people, they don't take showers too often, it seems. So there I was in London, and I walked that night to Piccadilly Circus, and there it was, that big famous Coca-Cola sign, and I just knew this was where I needed to be, and it was going to test me, but I was ready for it.
Where did you start in terms of work, Petal?
I had a job at the ABC Cinema on Fulham Road, and I was doing shift work there. I was also doing 5 to 7 at a news agency behind the counter. And I was also on the weekend, I managed to get a baby walking job where I walked two children of a French family, they were terribly nice, into Hyde Park around on a Saturday and a Sunday afternoon. So I had three jobs.
I've never heard of baby walking, but
yes,
that's wonderful.
Baby walking. But I also had, and here we had the third wonderful woman in my life, a teacher, Maria Fay. And I'd heard about this very famous Hungarian teacher. So I went along there and she immediately took to me, and she knew I was Australian. She knew I had absolutely nothing and no recommendation. But my goodness, she saw something in me, and she said to me, you know, you will work, but you need to be in condition. So I would go to her class every morning. But after, I think it was about 3 weeks, I said to her, look, Maria, you know, my three jobs are not going to supply six classes a week. I can only come three times a week. And I remember it so well. She said, listen here, Petal. She said, in order to get the job, she didn't say, if you get the job, in order to get the job, you need to be in peak condition. So I need you to come six times a week. And when you get the job, you will pay me. Hmm. Never forgotten it.
What a wonderful teacher.
Yeah.
Well, your first dancing job in England wasn't as prestigious as the main stage in the Royal Ballet or anything like that. Pantomime.
Yes, it was Aladdin's Lamp. And we were to go to Stoke-on-Trent just before Christmas. a tiny bit of money, just enough to get by. And I listened very carefully to the other dancers because they were well-seasoned troopers at the panto game. And they said, well, here's the number of a missus. She'll have a room for you. And it was £5 a week with a cheese sandwich at night. And she said, no heating, love, no heating. I said, okay. And it was the coldest room I'd ever been in with ice in the windows. I slept fully closed for the full term of my contract, which I think was 3 weeks over Christmas. And that was the pantomime of Aladdin. But I was thrilled because it was my first professional job. Somebody wanted me.
Petal, what was the advert you then saw for a dancing job in Paris?
They wanted three disco dancers to have 4 weeks in Paris dancing go-go dancing.
Is that something Madame Kira trained you in?
Oh, that's what she trained me for. And on illuminated drums. And I thought, oh, my God, Paris, I'm almost there. And, of course, the audition was just a free-for-all. There were about 60 dancers with the music blaring, just go for it. And three of us got the job. We were called back, you and you and you, and you'll be leaving for Paris on the weekend. We will billet you in a sort of a dormitory with a shower behind a screen, and you'll be there for 3 weeks, and you will take it in turns, three at a time on the drums. We will give you an evening meal, and in the day you're free.
Probably better than a cheese sandwich.
There we are.
Paris. What was the club like? What did it look
like? Oh, it was wonderful. And it was on the left bank, and I remember it had red carpet on the walls and the ceilings and a glitter ball, and the music was terribly loud. I thought, oh, I've arrived. I live in Paris. I'm Parisian.
1960-something?
66.
1966.
Because I arrived in 65.
What did you have to wear while you were going?
Mini skirt, very, very short mini skirt, long black hair. And of course, you know, we were treated royally because we'd come from swinging London. We were the real deal and we were very popular. And of course, I walked the streets of Paris during the day and then I came upon the Paris Opera House, the Garnier.
And what was that like?
Well, I remember standing in front of it and thinking, this is the home of the Paris Opera Ballet. This is the womb of French ballet. And I'm sidetracked. I need to rein myself in.
More go-go dancing.
No. as much as I love my go-go dancing, I need to go back to London and get back on track, go back to Maria.
And back into serious dancing.
Yes.
Well, as your dancing career was starting to take off in London, where did you run into an old friend from Perth?
Yes, I was walking down Earls Court Road and there in front of me was Michael Manning. Or Michael Brown. And Michael and I had danced together in The King and I in Perth. He was a Perth boy. And when we met in The King and I don't know how old we were. We might have been 14. And we got on famously. Michael was artistic. He was funny. He was witty and clever and adored me. And lo and behold, we struck up a wonderful relationship in the middle of swinging 60s and we got married.
You got married. What was your wedding like?
Wonderful. We married at Brompton Oratory, the big Catholic cathedral. How we worked it.
I thought that was only for proper posh people.
Absolutely. You know, you virtually had to be born within the pillars of Buckingham Palace. We rocked up there to this wonderful priest and said, we want to be married. And he said, oh, well done. Good. Come on in. And so it happened.
What did you wear?
I wore a mini dress. And I said to him, can I wear a mini dress? And he said, it's got to cover your knees.
That's
I said, absolutely. And of course it didn't. It didn't. And we were pictured in the Evening Standard. And I've still got those pictures of us both in a ballet position. And yes, I've got I made the dress and I had a flowered bonnet and little white ankle strap shoes and white stockings. And we were very much in love.
Where did the two of you begin your married life?
in London, and then we both got jobs in South Africa. We went to PAC Ballet, Performing Arts Council of Transvaal. We auditioned. I think they had three contracts. We got a couple of contracts. They flew us off to Johannesburg. And a friend of mine who actually lives in Perth, she said to me the other day, she said, you know, when you and Michael arrived in Joburg, we thought Carnaby Street had entered. You were completely everything we wanted to be.
That was, of course, during apartheid. How did that strike you?
It was very shocking. It was very shocking. It was a huge learning curve. And the artistic director, I'd only been there a week, and I was called into her office, and she said, Petal, my dear, you're really too familiar with the staff. And I'm familiar with the staff. I don't actually know the staff. In the canteen, my dear, talking with the staff. Well, you know, I was being completely civilized with the people that served me, saying thank you and have a good day and how are you? But I think they suspected that I wasn't aware of boundaries. And of course, the worst thing, Sarah, was performing to segregated audiences, and those doors would close, we would be locked in, and the black community were locked out and they couldn't see us dance. So this was difficult. Having said all of that, I made a lot of friends and gained a good ballet repertoire.
You and Michael then went off to dance in Canada. How did the climate there suit a girl from Perth?
Well, we went back to London because it was me. I wanted to dance in London, London Festival Ballet. So I went, and the director of London Festival Ballet was a very tall ex-ballerina of the Royal Ballet, very, very British. And I did my audition with the ballet company, and she said, oh, my dear, she said, you're so sore. What would I do with you? So I was yet again devastated. And that was my third rejection of ballet. So there was an audition at the Dance Centre for the Royal Winnipeg Ballet. And we thought, oh, my goodness me, that means travelling all over North America. We both got the job. They flew us to Winnipeg. And, of course, it was 40 below freezing when we arrived, which I thought my little English double-breasted winter coat would be fine. Not. But the management realized that we were ill-equipped, and they gave us an advance in salary because we had no money, and sent one of the dancers with us to Portage Avenue to deck us out in decent winter gear. So we got the gear, and we toured the world, including Australia.
Did your parents get to see you, including your father, who'd been
the first
so opposed?
They did. Yes, that was the first time. They only actually saw me dance twice in my career. But, you know, it was a jewel for them, yes.
Finally, you got your shot with the Royal Ballet, Petal, which is something you'd been chasing for so long. How did that come about?
So I fronted up to the Royal Ballet on Talgarth Road and had nothing to lose, introduced myself, and the dancers around about had said, you need to speak to a woman called Iris Law. So I asked for this woman and I said, I'm Australian, I've done this, that and everything else around the world. I would like to audition for your company. Oh, she said, I'm afraid we don't audition. We have a school. I said, yes, I know you have a school, but I'm here. At least could I do a class? Could I join a class? She said, well, then come back tomorrow at 10:30 and do wear pink. I said, pink? Yes, my dear. Oh, so I went back to the ballet centre with my friends and said, has anyone got a pink leotard, pink tights, pink shoes, pink everything? Oh, yes, you're going to audition for the Royal? I said, yep. So I went along, arrived at 10:30, and she said, go down there and into that studio. And, of course, I opened the door and I was entering the principal ballet dancer's class, and there they were, these beautiful thoroughbreds. There was Monica Mason, Anthony Dowell, Antoinette Sibley, David Wall, Alfreda Thorogood, David Ashmore. And I thought, oh, my God. And so I sort of crept onto the bar started the class. The ballet mistress glided by me, and in passing she said, "And how old are we?" And I said, 25. And she didn't even hear she'd glided past. So I did the class, and I felt I'd kept up quite well. And I kept telling myself, stop looking at these wonderful creatures. Just do your class, do your best, which I did. Went back down to Iris Law and said, could I please come tomorrow? Please let me come tomorrow. Oh, all right, then 10:30. So I fronted up again. And during that class, I don't know what had happened between the ballet mistress, Iris Law, or what they were needing. But during that class, two men entered the room. And one, of course, I knew later on was Sir Kenneth MacMillan, the resident choreographer and director of the company, and Peter Wright. After the class, Peter Wright said, you're the Australian girl. And I said, that's right. He said, so where did you train? What have you done? Well, off I went, Winnipeg, go-go dancing, South Africa, trained in Australia, Russian teacher, and so on and so forth. Oh, my goodness, he said, that's really impressive. He teetered over to the other gentleman. They looked as though they were having a bit of a smile about all this. And he came back and he said, you know, if you're available, we've got an educational program going out on tour called Ballet for All, and we've got a position there for a dancer. You'd have a rehearsal for a couple of days only, and you'd be out on the road for considerable weeks with six of our dancers from the company. Was that something that would interest you? I was like, well, interest me? Really? So I said, oh, yes, yes, yes. When do I start? So that was the beginning of a 10-year relationship with the Royal Ballet.
Your career was really taking off, but how was your relationship with Michael changing during that time?
By that time, Michael had decided that the ballet, although he was good at it, it didn't fulfill him. And he was writing plays, writing books, painting. He, you know, he was one of those fascinating people that are good at lots of things. And also our relationship was changing. I knew that Michael no longer saw me as a lover. I was a great companion and a great love in his life, but the relationship was changing, and I knew why it was changing. Our needs were not being met physically.
So you realised that Michael was gay, but could you imagine life without Michael?
I realised that actually I didn't want to live without Michael, but it was impossible, really, to continue living with him because our needs were not being met. He was drawing away from me. I was drawing away from him physically, sexually, if you like. And I realized that I was more of a comforter to him than a lover. And I also knew that Michael had a journey, and he needed to make it without me.
Was that something the two of you kind of had the language for back then? Could you talk about it?
No, we didn't ever talk about that, but it was very evident. We didn't need to.
Well, as this sort of rupture between you and Michael
yes.
was becoming more evident, you were conscious that the nature of your relationship was changing. Who did you meet at the Royal Ballet?
I met the beautiful David Ashmole.
Do you remember the first time you saw
him? Oh, absolutely. And it was the first bit of writing I did when I was asked to give one page of writing. And I wrote about the first time I saw him. And I looked at him and I knew that I would love this man.
Why? What was it?
Just knew. There was something about him that was irresistible.
How did he look back then when you first met him?
Beautiful physique, perfect classical prince dancer heading the world's best ballet company. Quiet man, very quiet. I'm attracted to men that are very good at what they do, but they don't need to convince you. You know, he was very quiet about his ability, his gift. And he was a gentle person and a gentle man. And I knew that we were falling in love.
How quickly did you begin a relationship?
Oh, I would say virtually immediately.
And that led eventually to you breaking things off
yes.
with Michael and separating.
Yes.
although he resisted that, did...
Oh, heavily.
Yeah, tell me about that.
I think, Sarah, because not only... we both knew we had to recognise that our needs were not being met, but you see, I'd fallen in love with someone incredibly beautiful and very secure and holding a top position in the Royal Ballet. And Michael, I think, found that very difficult. So he resisted and he was very severely depressed. And once I left him, I knew I couldn't live without him. It wasn't that I would never see him again. He would always be in my life. Fortunately, David recognized that and knew that, and that was never an issue. But, you know, he went into therapy, and I did too. We had the same therapist. And he was so distressed about it that, you know, he really wanted to die. And I think he hadn't actually really recognized his gayness. It was perfectly obvious to everyone else, and particularly to me. But at that time, he wasn't ready to go there. And I left and I said to the therapist, I'm in a complete dilemma because if I don't go back to Michael and he does end his life, how will I live my life? And she said, is that the reason you would go back to him? Is that a good enough reason? And the answer to that was no. No. But then he was brave enough to actually live the life he wanted, which was a gay life, and he lived it well.
What was it like for you seeing him flourish, I guess, true way?
Wonderful. And we became closer than ever because I saw Michael being the person he really needed to be. He was even funnier. And he adored me even more because there's nothing more wonderful for a woman than being adored by a gay man. They do it really well. And that love blossomed and bloomed with the support of David. Yes.
David eventually accepted a contract with the Australian Ballet.
He did.
And the two of you moved to Melbourne.
Yes.
What about your own dance career, Petal? Like, was there a clear moment for you when you thought, my time as a dancer on stage is
yes.
coming to an end?
I was 39.
Is that old for a dancer or not?
Yes, yes, it's a good age, absolutely. You know, I loved being on the stage. I was a sort of dancer, but I was sort of fearless about everything. But there came a time in my late 30s that I knew that my body was not as obedient as it had been. I knew there were parts of my technique were murky and becoming difficult. For example, I was a very good turner. I turned instinctively and suddenly I couldn't correct it. I couldn't find it. And so I knew that it was time.
Well, what stepped forth once you retired? Where did you turn your energy to next? Was teaching able to give you some of the joy that dancing
did? Oh, absolutely, and still does. You know, that was what I wanted to do because I was a very curious dancer. I was probably a nuisance to the ballet staff. But, you know, I was curious about technique. I was curious about performance level. And so I learned a lot as a dancer about performing and teaching. And so it was really quite automatic. And when we got to Australia, Maynard Gilgood offered me a position on the ballet staff and I became ballet mistress and teacher and coach to the Australian Ballet and David was principal dancer.
Then in 1990, your first husband, Michael, got in touch with some awful news. Yeah. What had happened?
He called to say that he was going to San Francisco for 3 weeks and just said, wish me luck because it's going to be great. It's summer. And a month later, he came back and called me and said he was unwell. And he didn't know what the problem was. And I said, well, you know, go to the doctor. A couple of weeks passed and he called and said, I've got this HIV virus. And I remember thinking, I know what this is. And I was devastated.
What did you do?
Michael went straight on to, started on the only drug they had available at the time, which is AZT. But he lived in hope, you know, and he said, oh, the monster's got me, but I'm going to be fine. Well, very quickly, he was not fine. And it became apparent to me that Michael, virtually living alone in London, what was going to happen to him? And so I said to David, I have to go and look after Michael. I can't not do this. And so I did.
When you first arrived back at that house that you lived in together and saw him again, how did he look?
He was withered. He was terribly thin, and he had hollow, sad eyes. His beautiful white teeth were yellow. He was terribly sick. And he used to call me Blossom, and he opened the door, and there was the shadow of this beautiful man who was diminishing before my eyes. And he just opened his arms and held me, which was such a familiar feeling. It smelt like Michael's neck. He just held me for the longest time because I was so broken at the sight of this man. He then took me into the kitchen, turned away, put on the kettle, looked back at me and said, Blossom, thank you for coming. And we cried because we knew what was ahead. I didn't know whether I could cope with that, but I knew I had to.
You spent the next 6 months with Michael in that home that you'd once shared as a married couple. What was life like day to day?
Well, we settled into a life of medication, a life of blood transfusions, a life of holding each other and crying or laughing and laughing about old times. We clung on to each other, but the daily routine was medication, pain prevention. It was a special time. It was a sacred time, really.
Were you with him right to the end, Petal?
Absolutely. When it became at home, it became clear to me that I could no longer handle pain control. One night I wrapped Michael up and did the thing he didn't want ever to do, but I took him to a Mildmay Mission hospice. And it was late at night and they didn't have a bed for us. And I think I became like, some sort of wretched devil woman because I said, you have to help us. So eventually they very kindly found us a room for the two of us. And we lived in that room for the next 3 weeks until Michael died.
What sort of state were you in at the end, when Michael did finally die?
Oh, I was completely grief-stricken. And I washed him and dressed him in the clothing that he loved, which was his red trainers and his cap and his red scarf. And then I lay beside him and stayed with him until it was time for the staff to take him away from me. It was very torturous for me, because I was losing this great love.
Mm. You had another great love, David, waiting for you back in Melbourne. And once you returned, there was a lovely period in your life of you running your own dancing school. And David was still dancing.
Yes.
How was he handling the prospect of retirement? You say for you it was clear for you when it was time. Was it like that for him?
No, it wasn't. When I got back from Michael's death, of course, David was his compassionate, kind self. He knew that what I was going through. But then, also David was coming to the end of his career. And he was struggling with that because he was completely dedicated to dancing. And unlike me, who I'd go to every other person's performance and talk about it forever, David never ever did that. And he used to say, I know you love talking about it. I know you love looking for future potential. I only love doing it.
What did he think he might replace ballet with?
I believe he was grief-stricken. He was never quite the same again. He missed it terribly. He didn't really want to be a teacher. He loved Australia. He was intoxicated with Australia, the lifestyle, the people, the weather, everything. He wanted to see Australia, so he took his heavy-duty truck driving license.
Got a truck driving license?
He did.
This ballerina. Could he not just drive a four-wheel drive like everybody else?
And he wanted that because he said, there's only one way I'm going to see the internal workings of the country, if I can get in a truck. Well, I thought it was the most terrible idea. I thought, oh, my God. And he failed it twice. And I said, well, perhaps it's not for you. No. So he had private lessons and he eventually got the truck license.
And did you sit up with him there in the cab?
No, because
pedal?
I tell you, between you and I was terrified of him doing this because he was 40. But of course, I had to be supportive. And, you know, I'd say, oh, congratulations, wonderful. And yes, you will see the red earth. And so he buddied up with the driver because he was a novice. And he did, I think, two or three trips, of course not by himself, with a buddy, and realized, he came home and he said, darling, this is a young man's game. I can't do this. And I said, oh, really? Oh, well, there'll be something else. I was thinking, thank God.
I commend his chutzpah in trying to make the transition from the ballet stage.
Chutzpah's the word.
Yes. To the big rig license.
And so he did tiptoe back into teaching. And I understand from the dancers and the students that work with him, he was wonderful, of course, because he was gentle and understated, and it was never, this is how I did it. He also took up tennis and swimming and became a very good tennis player, as he would. Mm.
Petal, you and David had been married for 30 years and moved back to London for a time where life was full of pleasures, travel, friends, fun. And then what news was David given?
Yes, well, things were going really well. But in spite of the tennis and the swimming and the teaching, he was having pain. He was in pain. And this went on for 18 months. And he'd say, oh, well, it's too much tennis, or I'm teaching pas de deux, or it's too much swimming, or too much walking, something. And I'd say, really? I think we need to go to the doctor. No. You're always running off to doctors. Finally, I took him to the doctor because I had an appointment with our lovely London doctor. And I said, I think David has cracked a rib. And she said, okay. So she tested him. She said, no, he hasn't cracked a rib, but he needs to have a scan. So we went the next day and we did the scan. We got home. There was a call from her. And she said, look, I'm sorry it's late, but I've heard from Charing Cross. They want to see David again tomorrow morning. And the first thing David said was, gosh, goodness me, the hospital, the National Health are on the ball suddenly. And we said, oh, well, that's good. So we trotted along and they did another scan and they said, don't go home, come back. So we went back and the doctor said, look, David, you have a very, very aggressive cancer. It's in your lungs, but that's the primary. It's in your liver and it's also in your bones. And so David said, so what's the plan? And he said, it's very late. I don't really have any treatment, David. You have best part of 3 months, probably. And in fact, we had 3 months and 5 days. And David went downhill very quickly. Within 5 days, he was in intensive care in Charing Cross. And then the staff sister said to me, look, Petal, I know we've said you can go home, but it's actually not going to be possible because David needs a lot of pain care. And that can only be given in hospice. And so we moved in and we had 3 months and 5 days. But sadly, David had a very, very torturous death, which sent me for 18 months into, I was traumatized.
After David's death, which was a horrible death, such a painful experience to go through and understandably took you quite some time to feel yourself again. What role did dance and teaching play in helping you recover after that?
I didn't have any family because my family were in Australia. My parents had died. I had nieces and nephews, but they were a long way away. So I was really by myself. I had, of course, my big ballet family. And when you've spent your life within a ballet company, you know, and especially if you don't have your own children, that family becomes yours, and that's what your tribe, that's where you belong. And they were very, very supportive, and I longed to be back in the studio, being with the people that loved me and understood what I... But it was too soon, and I knew emotionally I was not ready to do that. But the thought that it was there kept me on track and kept me upright, because I knew I had somewhere to go as soon as I was ready. But I was not ready for some time.
10 years after David's death, what did your neighbour convince you to do?
Well, actually, it was my Greek family. I was on Idra, the island that I'd been going to since I was a hippie child. And my Russian friend, you know, you come here every year, 7 years now since David dying, and you're still the widow, the widow. What is going? You need to open everything, open the heart. And I was quite offended. I said, absolutely not. You know, I'm quite happy the way I am. I went back to London. Her word stayed with me, and I was talking to my lovely young neighbour who would have been in her 40s, and quite normally she said to me, "So, Petal, are you dating? What's with you?" I said, "Dating? What? No, I'm 70, darling." It just didn't seem gracious, the conversation even. I said, no. "Oh," she said, "for goodness sake, but Petal, you're very cool. You should be dating." I said, "Cool? No." So she said, listen, let me put you onto a dating site. I said, well, don't tell anyone. She said, "No, I won't say a word." So she took me inside and put me on a dating site, and we did a brief CV and some photographs. And I said, "Well, I don't know." She said, "Listen, just have a fiddle at night. Just get on here and have a fiddle." Well, I was shrieking with laughter because I thought this is such fun. And these sort of extraordinary males who, on the face of it, seemed appropriate, you know, professional vets and doctors and all sorts of people. And then, of course, they'd ruin it and say something random like, "Well, it's lovely talking to you, and do you wear stilettos?"
Uh-huh.
And I think, oh, please, no, no, no. And then I'd swipe you off. And then, of course, and amongst all this frivolous sort of play that I was enjoying, but in secrecy, mm-hmm. because I hadn't told anyone I was doing such a thing, it just didn't seem proper, really, at my age. And up popped Simon Winstanley, an architect, also a widow. So we were chatting, and we were talking about art, we were talking about architecture, we were talking about travel, we were talking about being widows. He had children, I didn't. He lived in Scotland, and I thought, oh, this is really lovely. So this went on for 3 weeks, and he then said to me, "Listen, it would be so lovely to actually speak with you. This is my phone number. If you ever would like, I'd love to hear your voice." So I went off air, picked up my phone and called him, and he said he almost fainted. He said, So I said, "Simon, it's Petal." Then we started chatting, and that went on every day, every night for about 2 weeks, and I'd fall asleep listening to him. And he eventually said, "I think we should meet. How about we have lunch and afternoon tea in York, beautiful York? I'll travel from Scotland, you travel up from London." Oh, I said, "I think it's a lovely idea." And I was already a flatter. I already knew that this man, his language and everything about this man appealed to me. And I just kind of felt safe in his conversation.
How did that first in-person meeting go?
Oh, well, I decided, because he said to me, "Look, it's a long drive for me, so I'm going to have a room in the hotel. I don't want to drive back to Scotland after you leave after afternoon tea." So I thought, well, what would happen if I miss my train? I don't want to be at this man's mercy. I don't really know him. So I will also book a room. So I said to him, "What hotel are you staying?" So he told me. So I booked a room as well. And I went up the night before because I wanted to be prepared. I hadn't dated anyone for God knows how long. And I thought, I don't know how the... I was quite nervous about this, but also very, very comfortable. And so I went up the night before into my room. In the morning, I was downstairs waiting. His car drew up. He got out of his car. I knew it was him. And I walked out of the hotel, opened my arms, and he just held me for the longest time. And incidentally, he didn't actually use his room. How naughty were we?
Oh, how wonderful. How different did it feel to fall in love at 70 versus at 21?
It was the most beautiful feeling because there was nothing like being in love. And, of course, I'd been in love on two occasions before. And I felt radiant. And, of course, Simon, he was ideal for me. We were the right age. He didn't know a lot about ballet. And I said, good, that's okay. You don't need to. You don't need to. I'll tell you all you need to know when the time comes. But he introduced me to architecture and opened a completely new world for me, and knowing me, asking thousands of questions. And so being in love with Simon was the greatest gift at 70.
Falling in love later in life, though, of course, the time you have together is inevitably shorter. Where did Simon propose marriage to you?
He proposed many, many times. And on that first date, we were walking past the cathedral in York, and he said, I've fallen in love with you. I said, really, Simon? And I thought, yeah, you have, and I have too. And over the period of 5 years we were together, he used to say things like, you know, I'm going to marry you. And I'd say, okay, right. I didn't jump at it, but I wanted to. But I thought, let's just, because I just loved the way we were. And when Simon became very, very ill, which is at the beginning of COVID, and he died during COVID, and like David, he was given 3 months, and actually we had 3 weeks because he already had Parkinson's, and then he developed esophagus cancer. And so we were in the hospice and having a round-the-bed meeting with the staff and the doctor. And the doctor, his oncologist, was lovely and the team were beautiful. And we're explaining to Simon that time was very limited. And said after that, he said, now, Simon, is there any questions you want to ask? And he said, yes. He said, I want to marry this beautiful woman. Well, they were in tears. I was in tears. And Dr. Miller said, shall do. And we were married in the hospice. And, of course, it was COVID, so only 5 people could be, the priest, myself, Simon, and 2 witnesses. And the hospice, they put fairy lights, and they made the most beautiful altar. And so we were married probably 3-4 days before he died.
Petal, you've experienced these great loves, but also such loss. You know, is it worth it? Is the grief that has followed the passing of these 3 men been worth it?
Oh, yes, and I'd do it again. You know, I was a cherished and dearly loved child, and I chose wonderful men to love me, and love me they did. And I think during the grief, when you recognize that you've been valued, I think that, you know, that is the thing that has kept me upright, that I knew how much those men loved me. And that love has stayed with me. It's not like there's an elephant in the room. They are in the room. Carrying the grief was also very sacred, because I think when you spend that time, and I have spoken to my family and said, I will not leave you traumatized. I want us to have time. When the time comes, if I'm diagnosed with something terminal, we will have our time of goodbye and love. And then I will deal with my end of life. I will not leave you traumatized, because I know about that. In the end of the conversation, they said, that's about your love for us. I said, it is.
Tell me about life first, Petal. What's day-to-day life like for you now?
as you know, I was born in Perth, and I left at 18, and it is 60 years since I have lived there. So I've been in transit, really, for 60 years. And there came a time when the burden of ambition had lifted. I more or less dealt with losing Simon. And my life in London, you know, I'd gotten to the stage where I was no longer utilising London, and London now has its issues. And I thought, you know, really, I'm at a time in life where only family will do. And it was very unusual because all my friends said, "You're going back to Perth? Good God, you're a London girl. You're too old to do this." Nope. I'm going back to Perth. Perth is the jewel of Australia, and I love it because I'd been back twice since Simon had died to visit my family, and I knew that family was where I needed to be. So I came back in December, and I'm in a retirement village in City Beach. I walk to the beach every day with my beautiful dog. I see my family. We're in and out of each other's houses. I'm writing another book, and I'm doing a tiny bit of coaching when I want to, and mentoring when I want to. But life is beautiful, and you know, I think when you come up for air, yes, I'm in the right place at the right time.
What about the other great love of your life, ballet?
Yes.
Do you still dream about your time on the stage?
Absolutely. I'm never without it. But the connection will always be there. It will never leave, no matter where I am.
Do you think the memory of all those dances, all that, those hours that you spent practicing and performing, are they still in your bones, in your body somewhere?
Oh, absolutely. You can't avoid it. It's there. It's part of your being. It's every breath you take. But also it comes in other forms, you know, music and art. So I'm curious, very curious still, thank God, at this great age.
Petal, it has been a delight to meet you. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
My guest on Conversations today was Petal Ashmole Winstanley, and Petal's memoir is called Get Up, Dress Up, Show Up. This episode of Conversation was recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples and produced by Maggie Morris. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.